Chapter 7. Hotel Maritime sits on one of the main streets of Bonn, Germany, with several associated buildings located just across that street. Bonn was the capital of Western Germany until the reunification, and the maritime complex was built for secure use by government officials. The hotel itself was a modern facility with glass walls, huge meeting rooms and auditoriums, spacious hallways and every modern amenity. Security for the Bilderberg meeting was very tight, as it was for the dozens of other meetings held there every year. Mostly for German, European and UN governmental groups. There were soldiers, camouflaged vehicles and coordinators with radios lining the driveways to the building. The attendees, in typical fashion, acted as if the security people were invisible. Philip and Bill McCoy had flown to Cologne that morning and taken two trains to arrive within a few hundred meters of the Maritime. They walked up to the hotel, smiling at a couple of friendly-looking soldiers along the way. "Hey, Philip, should I tell them that you're the guy who wrote Soldier with Honor?" Philip smiled. "Oh, not now, but you never know. We might want a few extra friends soon." "Well, maybe later, but don't worry about friends. I've already spotted one." The friend McCoy referred to was a member of the German military, but unbeknownst to his colleagues, he was off for a week, working for Bill McCoy. There were two others like him, one British and one Italian. They were being well paid to watch over the two men. A good friend of Bill's ran a security group in Berlin and had access to some of the best freelance soldiers anywhere. If there was a problem, half a dozen additional men could arrive within 2 hours, a dozen more within a day. Passing through security was fast and courteous. There was a walk-through metal detector and a passport check. The security people were the most professional and courteous that either Philip or McCoy had ever seen. At the end of the security area was a smiling young lady, handing them badges and welcoming them to the meetings. Once inside, there was a large coat and baggage check area to the left, hotel restaurants and stores in front of them, and large open areas and meeting rooms to the right. They made their way slowly toward the meeting rooms, while a greeter handed them schedules and brochures. The two men sat down at a small cafe area at the far end of the open area and reviewed the materials they were given. As they looked around, they saw several heads of state, broadcasters, and many significant businessmen. "It does have its own sort of charm, doesn't it, Philip?" Philip smiled. "That it does, my friend. There is definitely a high associated with status and power. And it does feel nice. But? But it's a rather nasty drug. If you get hooked on it, you keep going after power. And there is never enough. They've done serious experiments on this. People in power are healthier and more vibrant than others. It's chemical. Serotonin, mostly. The feeling is nice, but the addiction is deadly. Mostly to those around the addict. So do I walk out now or do I enjoy the high?" Both men laughed. "Oh, enjoy the high, Bill. Just don't enjoy it too much." As they talked and reviewed their papers, the President of Germany and their foreign minister briefly introduced themselves and said they hoped to spend some time talking to them in the next 2 days. Both Philip and McCoy thanked them and said they'd love to talk. A few minutes later, the chief executive of a European industrial conglomerate likewise greeted them and asked them if they would be at the evening cocktail party. After the industrialist walked away, they looked at each other as if to say, "Wow, this is something else." "Not your usual group of blokers, huh, Bill?" "Yes, I'd say not. Bloody amazing. But Philip, what do these people want from us? They're being very nice, but we are hurting them. They want us here for some reason. What is it?" "Well, we'll find out at the meetings, won't we?" "Yes, but I know there are ideas in that head of yours." Philip smiled. "Okay, the real insiders want to manipulate us into cooperating with them. My guess is that they want to merge the digital economy with the controlled economy. And these are not dumb people. They'll make a compelling case." "Yes, I expect they will. Remember also that there are several levels of people here." "Such as?" "Well, first, there are people who are here as a payoff and to get them hooked. You see the news people? That's mostly why they are here. They played the establishment line, or they're trying to get them to promote the establishment line. They come here, experience the cool serotonin rush, and are emotionally tied to the people they meet here. Then they are unlikely to say much against them, or will at least give them the benefit of the doubt. Probably for life. Then there are the government guys who are here to make friends and influence people. They want to get support for a new office, or maybe to get big people to support their ideas. McCoy had been watching people in the cafe and watched them evaluating their notes from various meetings. These guys seem to be interested in the content of the sessions, Philip. Oh, you're certainly correct, Bill. Actually, I suspect that we'll be interested in the content of the sessions as well. The people making the presentations are among the best and brightest anywhere. To be sure, but they seem more interested in the topics than in personal agendas. Yes, for the moment they do. It'll be very interesting to see if things change in the evenings and at private meetings. And when I say that they have agendas, I don't mean that they are necessarily malicious. They may very well think that their agendas will make the world a better place. The first meeting that morning was a lecture on Islam. The speaker, previously foreign minister of Italy, was extremely well-informed and articulate. Not only was the presentation excellent, but the question and answer period was likewise of very high quality. The same was true for a panel discussion of strategic defense that followed shortly thereafter. The subject was not as gripping, but the quality of the presentation was excellent. After the two morning meetings, there was a break for lunch. Philip and McCoy sat at a large table in the dining area, joined by three corporate CEOs, a reporter, and a former U.S. Secretary of State. Conversation began around the topics covered in the morning, with both Philip and Bill being fairly quiet. The Secretary of State knew that Philip represented the world of private commerce, and that it was rumored that Philip was a fascinating and original, if perhaps dangerous, thinker. He decided to probe him just a bit.
"So tell me, Mr. Donson, which of this morning's lectures did you enjoy more, and why?"
Philip smiled. "Actually, I enjoyed the lecture on Islam quite a bit. By nature, I am philosophically minded, so I like to understand the true nature of things. I've studied Islam a bit, but not nearly enough to get a deep understanding. The lecture this morning moved me along quite well. I liked that."
"And your thoughts on the possible conflict of civilizations?"
The secretary was trying to understand Philip's real depth. He was interested not only for reasons of statecraft, which he was still quite involved with, but also because he had heard of Philip's unusual and surprising intellect, and thought he might be a very interesting man. The secretary did not find many people who truly interested him.
"Yes, the difference in civilizations," Philip paused, recalling the analysis he had done several years before.
"Well, it seems to me that there is a very distinct difference in the base cultures. Judaism and the Christianity that came from it are essentially the religions of farmers. The first Muslims were herdsmen, and to this day, I think their culture still embodies the sensibilities of nomadic herdsmen. Farmers relearn to rely upon their neighbors. They help build each other's barns, share tools, lend their expertise for repairing their neighbor's equipment, and so on. They also respect each other's property lines. So in farming, there are long histories of mutual help and respect for property. Herdsmen, on the other hand, tend to mistrust their neighbors and to hide information from them. When the nomadic herdsman finds good grazing land, he does not share that knowledge with another nearby herdsman. If one finds a hidden waterhole, he does not disclose the location. So the overall balance is much more toward not helping a neighbor. Similarly, property is less respected in nomadic cultures. And of course, they develop different methods of warfare." The secretary was smiling and even scribbled a note on his handout from the Islam session. Philip went on, enjoying himself immensely. The secretary was an intelligent and well-read man and could understand the implications of what Philip was saying.
"Again, my understanding of the history of Islam is not terribly deep, but I have read the Quran and the Hadith." He paused. "I have not been impressed."
"And your thoughts on the current situation?"
"There are actually two things that concern me. First is the institutionalized teaching of hatred in the Islamic world. Secondly, that they seem to see all of life as a zero-sum game. The situation looks very bleak to me."
Conversation paused for a moment as they were eating. Soon, the newsman and the corporate executive took over as the primary speakers. As they all rose from the table to attend the next session, the secretary asked Philip for a minute of his time privately.
Obviously, Mr. Donson. Most everyone here knows who you are and who you represent. So you may expect a bit of questioning from people. They will, however, be civil, since that is the culture we have developed at these meetings. Now, as for me personally, I am not entirely opposed to your ideas. I have serious questions as how they'd play out, but I am at least partially persuaded. But of course, I'm not in office and I have that luxury.
Philip looked at the secretary. It seemed to him that he saw something in the man's soul. An exceptionally bright and insightful man who had few peers, who was offered job after job because of his unusual skill, but he was under no illusion. He knew the dirty side of the game he had played.
Yes, I understand what you mean by the luxury of being out of office. But what of the people here who are in office?
Well, as I said, they'll be polite to you, Mr. Donson. But do not forget that a man becomes a creature of his uniform. Many of these are good people, but when in power, they become creatures of their offices and their systems. In their natural state, they would be interested in your ideas and might even agree with you on some matters. But in office, only 1 in 100 would be capable of such a nobility. And the truth is, I don't know who that 1 in 100 might be.
I like you, Mr. Donson. You're deeply honest. And I don't see much of that. We'll probably see each other again here. But if not, my email address is on the roster. Please keep in touch.
Philip smiled.
I'd love to. Thank you.
The afternoon sessions were on NATO and the European Union. McCoy was more interested in these sessions than Philip was. Bill remained after the last session to talk with several British officials. Philip walked out of the cafe area and sat down to wait.
You looked a bit bored in the afternoon sessions, Mr. Donson.
Philip looked up. It was the secretary again.
It's funny, Philip thought, to be having a conversation with someone you've seen on television 100 times behind a government podium.
It somehow seemed that such people didn't really exist in life. Yet, here he was, as real and as normal as anyone else.
I only say that because I felt the same way many times, and I thought I recognized the look.
The secretary was hoping that he had not made a mistake. Philip smiled.
Oh, you got it right. I guess I'm not especially interested in the fine points of systems that I don't care for in the first place.
Yes, I understand. Would you like to have a drink, Mr. Donson?
That sounds wonderful. But if we're having a drink together, you should call me Philip.
The secretary smiled.
Very well, then. And you'll call me William.
The bar area was straight back from the front entrance, and not too long of a walk from where they were at the cafe. Most of the other attendees were dispersing, though a few remained in groups, talking. Philip and the secretary, William, sat down at the empty bar and ordered.
Just so you know, Philip, some of those people would like to talk to you.
Oh, I figured as much.
Why?
Did they send you as their emissary?
William laughed.
Oh, they wanted to. But I told them that you were quite accessible, and that they should ask themselves.
Philip appreciated this man more and more, but he still wondered if he was as decent as he appeared.
And what do you think their reaction will be when I tell them that I consider all coercion immoral?
To be honest, Philip, I think that they won't really understand it.
You mean they're trying to figure out my angle?
Yes, primarily.
And?
And if they can't control you or manipulate you.
So do you recommend that I let them think I have a scheme, or frighten them by revealing that I have none?
This is a very good question. Realistically, not many of them will believe that you don't have an angle, so if I were you, I would avoid the subject.
Yes, that sounds reasonable.
Philip paused for a moment and said,
So, come on, William. You're different from the rest of these guys. Is it just part of the job for you?
More or less. My career centered around strategic analysis. I was very good at it, you know.
He smiled.
Yes, Philip added a joking voice. Some rather prominent people have said so.
Yes, well, I got into all of those situations because of my analytic technique. It actually started in my later 20s, and before I realized, I was holding important offices and doing critical work. For a while, I enjoyed it immensely.
but it was a game to me. I was a little boy playing ball, and they were letting me play in the big leagues. By the time I realized the depravity of some of the people I worked for, I was in awfully deep. So, how did you handle it? First of all, it took me some time to come to grips with the situation. I gave them the benefit of the doubt for a long time. After all, this is the President of the United States asking me for advice. That's a unique and intimidating situation. And I was so focused on the issues sitting on my desk, and I didn't have time for other matters. But eventually I realized that I wanted to get out of it all. Finding a decent way out, however, was very difficult. There were so many crucial issues. A wrong decision from me could have led to war. So it took me several years to get out. It was a choice of the lesser of evils. Leaving earlier would have done better for me individually, but I had to stay until I could get out without causing people to die. It was not a simple proposition. No, I imagine it wasn't. They've tried to get me back, you know. I suspected as much. But no, I didn't know. Yeah, several times. I will do consulting work for them from time to time, but I'm done being too deeply involved. I'm here partly because I like being informed by smart people, partly because I want to see what's going on through these people's minds, and partly to keep my consulting business going well. It's a strange world in which I work. Yeah, I imagine it is. Do you miss the power? He chuckled. In a few ways I do. Riding around in limousines and in special airplanes, having traffic stopped for me. Big status things, I guess. Although I do still have a few of those. They provide their own special type of intoxication, but I don't miss them much. And they were always something of a moral irritant to me anyway. The accolades made me uncomfortable more than anything else. Yeah, I can understand that. Oh, your friend is looking for you. Philip turned to see Bill, walking around near the entrance looking for him. Bill, over here. He walked over as Philip and William sipped their drinks. I had thought I lost you, Philip. Oh, hello, mister.
William will be fine, thank you.
William, this is my friend Bill McCoy.
Pleased to meet you, Bill.
Likewise, I'm sure. Philip pulled up a stool for Bill and ordered him his usual gin tonic. So, Bill, interesting conversation? Yes, mostly. I informed the British Home Secretary of what some of my friends in the British military think of him. William laughed loud and long, while Philip looked shocked. Bill, we said we were going to be polite. No rants, no nastiness.
Oh, I was mostly polite, Philip. I just couldn't hold back altogether.
I served with dozens of blokes. Every one of them would have paid dearly for the opportunity to vent their spleen directly to that man. Well, since I'm the lucky bloke who actually got the chance, I couldn't in good conscience pass it up now, could I? Philip laid his head on the bar in resignation and in disbelief. William laughed harder still. My God, Bill, you're going to get us kicked out of this place. Don't worry about it. In fact, I've got dinner lined up with half of the G8. They want to talk to you. All right, but you don't have anything else that you absolutely have to say to any of them, do you? No, I don't think so. Philip looked at William. Well, thank God for that. They laughed again. After another sip of his drink and one more small laugh, William turned back to Philip.
So, do you think they're after one country, two system?
Yes, I'm about as certain of it as I can be. Why do you see it differently?
No, that would be my guess also. Well, I'll leave you boys to the evening's entertainment. I have a client dinner later. Good luck.
Philip and Bill went to their suite, washed up and relaxed for an hour before the dinner. At 8 o'clock, they met their party in the entrance area and took two cars to a restaurant in Cologne. It was a northern Italian restaurant, very nicely decorated. They were led to a beautiful private room and given three waiters. Both the meal and the service would prove to be excellent. The conversation through the beginning of the meal revolved around the day's activities and commentary on the various sessions and speakers. All participated, and the discussion was pleasant. After the main course, things began to change. Some of them began to make reference to unregulated business. Before long, the French ambassador turned to Philip and said,
Mr. Donson, aren't you concerned that your system has been making the world financial system unstable?
because Philip had already heard about every possible argument against private commerce, answering such a question was fairly easy for him.
Honestly, Mr. Ambassador, I'm not at all certain that is true. International financial systems have long histories of instability, and I can point to many other causes for the problems you are experiencing, including your continual manipulation of the markets. The one exception that I would make to that statement would be declining tax revenues. That is partially due to our system.
A British shadow minister then spoke. Very well then, do you not consider reduced tax revenues significant?
Oh yes, I certainly do. But you must already know that this is a matter of principle to me.
It's of course principle, said the shadow minister, but he had actually been thinking, principle, principle, like Margaret Bloody Thatcher, only worse. He continued, but declining tax revenues are a significant issue for all of us. How can we provide the services people need without money?
Well, the simple answer, sir, is that you can't. But I would like to explain a bit.
I should hope you would.
Then I will. First of all, you're blaming our systems for your reduced tax revenues. And as I say, that is partially correct. But we are not alone. There have always been black markets, secret bank accounts, and creative accounting. That came long before us. Next, we don't know or care if our customers pay taxes or not. We don't ask, and we don't advise them either way. Now, this brings us to the point. Once your governments cannot force compliance, the people do not pay. And since we do not assist you in that compliance, you are concerned, and indeed have tried to destroy our services. This is where the moral issue comes in. I consider all coercion to be immoral. Safe self-defense, and very few things of that sort. You would like me to force people to pay you. I will not do that.
And how do you, alone among philosophers, make that decision and overturn the entire history of government and civilization?
Very simple. By studying and by holding to the truth. You see, there has always been one huge issue that has twisted philosophy, and that is rulership. Moral philosophy can be fairly well understood as it applies to normal events, until you throw in the concept of the ruler. The ruler is always given right to do things that are considered immoral for an individual to do. This, of course, requires volumes of explanations, revisions, and creatively fraudulent excuses. The simple truth is, sir, that being ruled is a form of being in servitude. Now, you can argue that for days, I'm sure, but such arguments serve only to explain away obvious truths in the most creative manners possible. Now, that does make all of you some version of slaveholders. And of course, you think that I'm being quite crude and insulting. Let me say this. I doubt that any of you got into this position you hold because you wanted to make slaves. In fact, I'd be shocked. But whoever it was that set up systems of rulership 100 generations ago did make people into servants. And no matter what sort of ideas were in your minds as you went down your paths, you were operating within such a system. The Italian minister could not hold back anymore.
And who are you to make such pronouncements? His voice was filled with anger, with an obvious element of defensiveness as well.
I have no position or authority that entitles me to any pronouncement over you, sir. I am simply a thinking man. But you know that I speak the truth. You simply wish that I would not.
All right, gentlemen, let's have our dessert and calm down for a moment.
The French ambassador wanted to keep peace at the table, and did so expertly. It seemed that he was the leader of the small group. They ate their desserts, and conversation went back to the day's events, then to the sessions that would be held the coming day. After dessert was finished and drinks were being served, the French ambassador took over again.
Now, Mr. Donson, all of us have serious concerns about your private markets. I believe you are sincere in what you say about your moral issues. I, however, do not happen to agree, which I think you will acknowledge as my right.
Of course.
Very well then, here are my concerns, our concerns. Your services are making things very difficult for us,
and if we cannot pay our bills, elderly people will lose their monthly checks. Medical care will be eliminated, and there could be welfare riots. I know you don't want any of these things to happen, so don't you think there is some way that we could work together and eliminate such things?
Well, Philip thought to himself, he certainly is smooth. Philip took a slow drink of some of the finest port he had ever tasted and answered, "Actually, sir, the short answer is no, but I'd like to take a few minutes to explain that to you." Everyone but the French minister looked angry when Philip said no, though they remained silent. The French minister nodded and said,
"Please do, Mr. Dunson. Explain all you like. We are in no hurry."
Very well, then, Philip answered. He took another sip of his port and continued. First of all, I do not control the digital economy. No one does.
I'm sorry for interrupting, said the minister. But though you may not control them, you can still influence them. It is your moral philosophy that has guided them.
I think you overestimate that. I think my writings did have an influence, but so did the development of the internet and encryption. I had nothing to do with those things, and they made private commerce almost an inevitability. Yes, I guided and perhaps gave them a moral foundation, but someone else eventually would have done something similar. At this point, I don't think I could dissuade them from their paths. Even if I tried, they would probably think I had mentally snapped. I really don't think they would change their mind. But that is really a moot issue. The fact is that I'm retiring from the whole business. I need time off for health reasons. And once I've finished with these meetings, I'll write a goodbye note and then lay on a beach for a good long while. So that makes two reasons why I can't influence them for you. Now let me address a hidden concept that you referred to. You simply imply that if you don't provide money to old people or medical fees, that such things will not be done at all. You imply that this is either government or nothing. That is a false assumption. I don't want to attempt a history lesson here, but that idea is manifestly false. Everything that your governments do can be done by other means and done more efficiently.
But there are some things that can be done only by governments.
It was the Italian ambassador again, angry still. This time, Philip answered with force. His voice was not loud, but it was surprisingly strong and with complete conviction. No, sir, that is not true. The only thing that can be done by government and not by private groups is involuntary taxation, raising money without the permission of the donors. Make any sort of argument you like, and an honest economist can reboot it convincingly. If ever that was true, it is not true now.
Mr. Dunson, it was the Frenchman taking charge again, you do understand what kind of situation that places these men in, do you not?
Oh yes, sir, I do. Philip paused, knowing that what he was about to say would cause significant effects. If the governments these men ran became desperate, people could be killed. This thought weakened Philip for a moment. Real people being shot and imprisoned. He did not want to cause anything like that. And the other choice is... The thought leapt into his mind with such force that he almost looked around to see who said it. Yes, he thought to himself. The other choice is to help them trash the best path to freedom in centuries and doom generations to servitude. He thought about how strange it was to be the one man who should make such monumental decisions. Ah, well, he sighed to himself. I'm the guy who stepped up to the job, and I guess I'll have to do it. I will answer your concerns on this subject, gentlemen, and then we will be done with this line of questioning for the evening. Do we all agree? Everyone at the table agreed. Good. Then let me begin by saying that I have a good idea of where you'll have to take this. Draconian laws, hunts for fugitive money and fugitive citizens, outrageous penalties. Yes, I understand. The basic operating principle of your governments is being undermined. If you cannot take money involuntarily, you are out of business. My message to you, gentlemen, is that in the long run, you will go out of business. I do not expect you to like that, but I do hope that you will accept it. There really isn't much way around it anymore.
Please answer me honestly, and I promise you that I will not disclose what you tell me. If current trends continue, how long before your governments have to seriously cut back their spending? There was an uncomfortable pause, followed by answers from the Frenchman first. The estimates ranged from 2 to 5 years, more immediate than Philip had expected. Well, then you will have to make difficult choices quickly. That means that you have two essential choices. First, try to crush private commerce. And second, to adapt. I'll begin with the latter. My analysis is that your organizations will begin a classic devolution. This will manifest itself most painfully as a battle between central governments and local governments, accompanied by the secession of one service after another. The bedrock of your taxation is the ability to seize property for non-payment. The central government has something of an advantage at seizing financial assets, but the local governments have an advantage in seizing real property. Because of this, the local governments will win these battles, at least for the most part. If you want to stay in your business, you may wish to think about local government. But even local governments may eventually fall apart. There will almost certainly emerge free territories and free cities, where there is no forced taxation. In those places, what are now public services will be provided by private means. Remember that providing services is only a question of organization. To get firemen to show up and do their job, you have to pay them. Also to pay for their trucks and for the organization of their duties. Private companies can do that no less effectively than you can. And once your monopolies on these services are removed, the quality of service will rise as the overall cost diminishes. So, once a few free zones emerge, you will face competition. And, faced with a choice of using their own money as they wish, or having it forcibly removed from them, few people will choose your system. Now let me address the ugly scenario, where your organizations attempt to destroy the digital economy. Your only chance to do it is with Stalinist terror, and I don't honestly think most of you are willing to go that far. I hope I'm not wrong, because if you did go that far, you'd likely put the world into a new dark age. The entire world economy would collapse, and I'm really not sure how bad it could get. The Chinese could take over, or perhaps the Muslims. But while such dark situations as these might not occur, even the best of the scenarios are not quite bad. Thus far, I suppose you don't like my scenarios. Nonetheless, I do think they're accurate. Now let me conclude. I do not think you can get the Gamma people to turn around and go back. The genie will not go easily back into the bottle. I've already described to you what I think will happen regarding the devolution of your system. Next, I said that fighting it would be amazingly ugly. But this was only half of the story. I described the damage I thought you could do. There is another side to this, but I think you will like that even less. The truth is that you can either allow a slow devolution, or you can cause your own swift elimination. If you allow the digital economy to exist, you are likely to keep your game going through at least your lifetimes. But if you come after our people with force, you will drive them to destroy you. Right now, they aren't out to hurt you, only to be separate. But it would not take much for a lot of them to turn against you. You see, once they leave, it's usually only 6 or 8 months before the fog begins to clear. Then they begin to comprehend just how perverse state servitude is and how deeply it affected their lives. If you start hunting and killing them after they've passed that point, they are likely to turn on you with a force that you don't think possible. If you want to remain in power, or maybe even remain alive, I suggest that you leave them alone. You have great armies, but they have the 10 million best and brightest on this planet. Don't piss them off. I'm done, gentlemen. Shall we? With that, Philip followed McCoy, stood up, and headed to the front of the restaurant. And my sincere thanks to whomever it was that chose such a wonderful establishment. The rest of the men joined them. The ride back to the Maritime was quiet and polite.
though very tense. Bill and Philip sat at the cafe near the large meeting room, enjoyed a fine breakfast, and amusing themselves by watching the parade of impressive people that walked by, and by naming them and their titles. McCoy had taken a walk early that morning, the purpose of which was to check on his security men. In fact, he had spent over an hour talking not only with his three plants, but with half a dozen friends or friends of friends, people he had known in the British military or in his home office days. He also spread the word that the guy he was with was the one who had written Soldier with Honor. The security men were surprised and impressed. They asked Bill if they could meet Philip. McCoy, of course, agreed and set it up for the next morning. Two of the security men had followed Philip and McCoy to the restaurant that previous evening. These men were armed, as well as all of the security men, with 9mm automatic pistols, pepper spray, radios, and handcuffs. In addition, they had special stun grenades from Skunk 2. These fired an electromagnetic burst sufficient to stun any person within 20 meters of the device. This would obviously include Bill and Philip, but with everyone in the room down, the security men could drag Philip and Bill safely away before the others recovered consciousness. "So, Bill, just how safe are we here?" "Actually, it's looking quite good. Tomorrow early, I'm taking you to greet the men." "You told them I wrote Soldier with Honor?"
"I certainly did. I also told them that you'd spend some time with them tomorrow morning before breakfast."
"Good, that sounds nice. I like those guys."
"Yes, and they're thrilled that you're leaving the presidents, diplomats, and bankers to spend a bit of time with them.
But getting back to safety, our people are quite well in place and are following us on every evening activities. Everything is going well."
"Good.
I hope we don't need them."
"As always." As they finished their breakfast, the French ambassador from the previous night's dinner walked by and stopped at their table.
"Well, good morning, gentlemen. I must tell you that you made quite an impression at dinner."
"Would you like to have a seat, Ambassador?"
"For a moment, thank you."
"You realize," said Philip, "that we are not trying to maneuver anyone. I simply told the truth."
"Strangely, I think I believe you, Mr. Donson. Some of the others, however, think that you are, how is it that you Americans say, playing hardball?"
"Yes, you said it correctly. That was one of my concerns going into the meeting. So what are they going to do?"
Under normal circumstances, such a direct question to a diplomat is not asked, and certainly not answered. But Philip and the Frenchman had developed something of an unspoken understanding. The two were far better matched intellectually than any of the others at the dinner, and a certain affinity developed.
"Of course, I cannot comment authoritatively on the long term, but I know that they reported quite quickly and completely to their organizations. I also know that another, different group of men would like to see you this evening."
"And your thoughts on them, and on the evening confronting us?"
"I think you shall find a quite different perspective than the one you faced last night."
The meetings the second day were of the same exceptional quality as the first. The two morning meetings covered satellite-based missile defense systems, with a wonderful panel discussion, and the possible development of China into a market economy, though not necessarily one based on democracy. At lunch, they sat with a group of professors, old money investors, and corporate executives. The conversation was cordial, with several people at the table asking serious questions as how the digital economy worked. This time, McCoy answered most of the questions, while Philip listened. Bill explained the various types of investment vehicles that existed in the cyber world, about venture finance in the gamma markets, and about the significant rates of return that were achieved. He also explained that in a tax-free environment, investment returns and capital appreciation were frequently spectacular.
"Run the numbers for yourselves," he said. "Whether it's your personal money or business money, calculate the next 10 years assuming a taxed economy, and then make the same calculation assuming an untaxed economy. The difference will shock you."
The table went stone silent after this statement, while they all did preliminary calculations in their heads, made mental notes to do proper calculations later, and had the good manners not to appear eager to consider the idea.
"And of course, gentlemen, all of these things exist now, and if you would wish to partake of them, you could do so in complete privacy and anonymity. No one else would know. But let me go further. You gentlemen don't know me, but I have made a living as a financial consultant to a fair number of your peers, I know your concerns. I know how you've handled your affairs. One of the investor, an elderly man with an English accent, spoke up.
And what, sir, do you think those concerns are?
Well, you will please forgive my presumption on familiarity with your situation, Mr. Worthington, but I have done considerable work for some of your friends. I always keep my clients' names unmentioned, but I assure you that you do associate with some of them. Your most basic concerns are with your public image. Wealthy people are negatively portrayed continually, and you have come to accept this as a reality to which you must adapt. So you pursue your own interests in one hand, while carefully cultivating your public image on the other.
So then, you do not hold that we are selfish manipulators getting rich off the efforts of the working man?
Certainly not. I have known a few people in your situations who were malicious, but quite the minority. When some of you make political contributions in return for tax advantages, I understand. You're trying to protect yourselves. And I fully understand that the people who are most vocal against you would do the same if they were in your situations. Your problem is that you are the obvious targets for humanity's envy. So you cloak yourself in the political causes of the average man and make sure that your public image is pristine and benevolent. What choice do you have? Lenin showed you what happens when envy is fully unleashed. You and your families die quickly. That is why the digital economy is especially important to you. There is no way for anyone to know who you are or how much money you have. Living in a mansion would identify you as rich, but nothing in our world can identify you. Envy, religious hatred, ethnic hatreds, and all the others have no significance in a world of anonymity. In our conversations, most of us do prefer to express our personal opinions, including cultural experiences, but you do not have to. And if you want to disguise your identity as something else, you may do that as well. There is no way of tracing a cyber identity to a physical identity unless you yourself give people clues. At this point, the next meetings were about to begin. They all gathered their notes, took their last drinks of water, and began heading to the meeting room. But as they did, Bill concluded with one final comment. And by the way, gentlemen, my email address and web pages are noted on the roster. Should any of you have any interest in further discussion, please feel free to look at the webpage. Then contact me privately. They all headed back to the meetings. As they went, Bill leaned close to Philip and said, "How much would you care to wager that I hear from three of them within the next month?" "Think so?" "Absolutely. I've never told you this, but I've been doing business for three English lords and five members of the Italian Senate for the past 10 or 15 years. Most of those people have secret bank accounts and secret investments. Simply a matter of maximized survival." The first afternoon meeting covered the exceptional mobility of American culture, with an enormous number of people leaving the place of their birth and completing their lives in a distant place, and the effects of the same thing happening in a unified Europe. The second involved some rather arcane financial analysis, and they were both bored. After the last meeting, Bill and Philip followed the same pattern as on the previous day. Philip went to the bar, and Bill remained in the meeting room, talking with whomever interested him. Philip was happy to see the secretary walking over to him at the bar. "Hello, William. Care for a drink?"
"Thank you, yes."
He sat down a bit wearily. "Scotch on the rocks," he said to the bartender. William looked around to verify that no one would overhear their conversation.
"Well, I heard all about your meeting last night. You held your own quite well with them."
"Thank you, but I'm not sure most of them really understood me."
"Oh, believe me, they understood some of the things you said quite well."
"Such as?"
"Such as they should think about moving into local government positions, and that their systems are set to devolve into nothingness."
"And what kind of reactions did it solicit from them?"
"Oh, fear, mostly. That and anger."
"Yeah, that is what I expected."
"Listen, Philip, you might be right about the... what do you call it?"
"Usually gamma, or just the digital economy."
"Thank you. Well, you may be correct. The best and brightest are certainly joining you.
And plenty of middle-class people as well, William. I didn't tell that to the group last night, but it's true. We have plenty of plumbers, managers, and shop owners."
"Ah, then all the more certain that the devolution will occur. but there are many ways that such a devolution could occur, and some are far better than others.
And what are you thinking of, William?
When people in power are to lose that power, for whatever cause, you have to give them a painless way out. If you do not, they will cling to their power till their dying breath. If they control the military, they will use it. If they control the courts, they will use them. You must make it easy for them to walk away. That means that when any government office has lost its support, you must get someone to hire the office holders and give them honorable jobs, a way out that does not cause them shame. If you do not, they will use any power they have, and I don't think I have to tell you that such circumstances have unpleasant results.
No, you don't. And you make a very good point. I think perhaps we will want to begin using your services.
Well, that would certainly be fine, Philip, but I was not trying to promote myself.
Philip laughed gently and put his hand on William's shoulder. No, I'm sure you were not, but your analysis is compelling.
And who do you think will hire me, Philip? You don't seem to have any collective arrangements at all.
Ah, no, you misunderstand. We're not opposed to all collective action, only to involuntary collective action. Actually, we have both collective arrangements and even hierarchical arrangements, but they always end up being temporary and voluntary. I assure you that there are more than enough concerned individuals to afford your services. We have several legal defense funds, insurance funds, and the like. A strategic initiative fund would operate similarly. And believe me, our people are deeply interested in the devolution of state power in the safest, most orderly manner possible. They will pay.
Very well. Then I will be pleased to assist. But please do not ever use my name. It could make great difficulties for me, you know?
Absolutely agreed.
I see your friend Bill is coming again. I'll bet that he has arranged for you to meet a more interesting group of people this evening.
McCoy was smiling as he walked up.
Hello, gentlemen.
Philip was concerned.
What? Philip, you don't trust me?
McCoy was enjoying the moment.
What did you do?
McCoy laughed.
No, don't worry about it, Philip. I didn't do much this time. No one was offended.
Then why were you laughing as you walked up?
Oh, I think I just subverted half a dozen statists and brought them into the free world.
Yeah, that's been your mission all day.
Excuse me, William interjected, but are you saying that you just brought six of those men into your system?
At least I think I have.
In God's name, how?
By telling them what level of capital appreciation they can obtain there.
William sat back and turned slightly to address them both at once.
And it's really that good?
Oh, absolutely, said Bill.
Just let me know when you're ready, and we'll tabulate the numbers.
Very interesting.
They sat silently for a moment. Then Bill spoke up again.
Oh, I forgot to tell you. We have another dinner set up.
And with whom, asked Philip in a mock English accent, is it this time?
That's a good question, said Bill, turning serious again. The president of the Federal Reserve Bank in Boston, to start with. But beyond that, I don't know. We're just supposed to meet in front at 8.
Philip turned to William.
Oh, should be interesting, no?
William smiled. I think you'll find it very interesting, as I think I know who these people will be, more or less.
Any advice?
No, nothing springs to mind. You'll be honest as usual, and some of them will appreciate that,
while others won't.
They're another type of international player. They won't really try to bully you, though they may try to win you to their cause.
Oh my, how very interesting.
Yes, tonight should be an interesting one for you, gentlemen. Now I'll leave you for the evening. I have a young lady to meet for dinner.
William paused and leaned closer.
Or at least she's younger than me. It gets rather relative after a while.
They all laughed and headed back to their rooms to prepare for the evening's events.
The dinner was held in an elegant and old private residence less than half an hour from the Maritime. The banker was present, as were a number of very significant retired businessmen, attorneys, and officials. Dinner was exquisite, as they had expected, and the conversation was engaging. After some time spent on more mundane matters, the discussion came around to the previous night's dinner. The Federal Reserve banker, Dr. Donnelly, addressed Philip directly for the first time since their original introduction.
"You understand, Mr. Donson, that the people you shared dinner with last night are concerned with rather short-term things. We, on the other hand, are concerned with the next few decades. I think you know how things sometimes work in big business, planning years in advance and pursuing opportunities that may take decades to play out. This need is even greater in the largest of human endeavors, democratic governments. Someone has to plan for the future, and since we are in the position to do so, we have taken it upon ourselves."
Philip smiled and laughed almost imperceptibly.
"You are amused, Mr. Donson?"
"Oh, yes. I am sorry. I do not mean to discount you or your work, Dr. Donnelly, but I find myself in a humorous position." They looked at him, not understanding.
"Well, you must understand, gentlemen, that I was born into the advantageous situation that you were, and I had to discover, with much effort, many of the things you take for granted. Along the way, I ran across dozens of wild ideas that I had to sift through myself, having no one who could help me understand them."
As Philip paused for a moment, Dr. Donnelly said,
"I'm sorry, Mr. Donson, but I still do not understand."
"Yes, I wasn't done. I was thinking about the way of explaining this. I suppose I'll be blunt. I was laughing, thinking about all the conspiracy theory people and what they would trade for an opportunity to fill my seat this evening."
The rest of the people at the table weren't sure what to think of that statement and nearly held their breath, waiting for Philip to continue.
"Oh, don't worry, gentlemen. If you had grown up on the streets of Brooklyn, that would seem funny to you as well. I understand who you are and what you do. And no, I do not believe that you are trying to secretly steal the wealth of the world."
"And what do you think of us, Mr. Donson?"
asked an elderly man with an unusual English-Australian accent.
"I think that you are, as Dr. Donnelly said, a group of men concerned with the long-term aspects of democracy. None of you are beholden to elected office, and your commitments to individual governments and officials are temporary at best. You are all independently wealthy, and generally have huge amounts of capital at your disposal. So you do what office holders cannot do. They are enslaved by popular opinion. They are forced to consider policies that have short-term benefits and may lead to serious long-term hazards. You work behind the scenes to counteract the foolish acts of the popularity contest winners and seek the long-term benefit. Am I close?"
"Answered quite well, sir," said the old man. "And if you don't mind, please continue."
"As you wish. You influence people and events. As I said, you have vast wealth at your disposal to finance projects and ideas that you think are important. In addition to that, you have working relationships with almost all of the wealthiest families in the English-speaking world, and I'm sure elsewhere. You use those contacts to extend your influence that much further. And of course, you must employ agents of influence in a dozen different areas, especially in molding popular moods. As best I can tell, your desires are mostly benevolent. You act to improve life on Earth and to avoid major negative consequences. At least that is your aim."
Dr. Donnelly spoke again.
Very well then, Mr. Donson. Now that we have that out of the way, let me address our concerns."
"Please do," said Philip.
"You are trying to wake people up, Mr. Donson. Am I correct?"
"Yes, primarily. But with me personally, it's that I was trying to wake people up. I'm retiring once I finish these meetings. I've stretched myself far too thin and for far too long. I need a decade or two off. But yes, insofar as my writings continue my work, I am trying to wake people up."
"And how many people have you woken up, Mr. Donson?"
"If you count all the people in the digital economy as awake, I'd have to guess at least 10 million.
"And these people have, as you say, opted out of the general political systems?"
"For the most part. They conduct as many of their activities as possible outside of the system, but they do work within it when necessary."
"We are very concerned about the long-term consequences of this,"
Very well. In what way?
Like you, Mr. Donson, I'll be blunt. If you provide a way out of the system for the top 10%, the entire system will fail for economic reasons.
Yes, I'm sure that's true. But you are saying that you want to use the hardest working people as beasts of burden to keep a political system going.
I would not say it that way.
Why not? Making the words sound less ugly will not change the reality. In the current system, the top 10 or 20% of productive people are slaves to the collective. Half of their earnings are taken from them. They are penalized simply because they work hard to improve their lives. If you wish to purvey such an idea, at least have the courage to face it honestly.
Very well, they are enslaved, and we want to keep it that way. I don't like saying it that way, but you do have a point. There is, however, another side of this issue. If this situation does not remain as it is, the consequences could put civilization back 500 years.
Oh, I quite disagree, Dr. Donnelly.
I understand, Philip, if I may call you by your first name.
Please do.
Thank you, I'm Timothy. If you pull out the top performers, the rest of the system will be unable to support itself. The consequences would be dire and would long endure.
Donnelly rose from the table and pulled the curtains open on a window that overlooked, at some distance, a commercial thoroughfare.
You see the trucks down on the street, do you not?
Yes.
Very well. Now look at the various delivery drivers in the trucks. There's one. Do you see the auto part trucks and the driver?
Philip had walked closer to the window and nodded yes, that he did see the man. It was difficult to see well, but the man looked to be in his later 30s and somewhat disheveled.
Donnelly closed the curtains again and they went back to their seats as Donnelly began to talk.
As you know, there are millions of such people, Philip. They're right on the edge. If more than one or two things go wrong at once, they become unstable. They haven't gotten what they wanted out of life, and they are angry. What happens to this man if his mother's check from the government stops coming? What if he loses the never-ending series of diversions from his unhappiness and has to confront it directly? Perhaps you have not studied history as deeply as we have, Philip, but when economies break down, people like that are easy marks for charismatic leaders. Let the current world system break down, and these people will be ready. Anyone promising them vengeance and giving them someone to blame will have a million slavish followers tomorrow. Your system is far too individualistic, Philip, and such individualism could lead us to breakdowns and into a third world war. Then how much benefit would come from your top 10%?
Philip's expression was a sad half-grin.
I understand your argument, Timothy, but I do not agree.
And how can you not? To dispute the state of people such as that man? If so, history says that you're a fool.
Yes, I do dispute the characterization of their base state. What you are telling me, Timothy, is that these people cannot be left to their own devices, that they must be managed, kept full of beer, cigarettes, and television shows, that if they were not, they would become angry mobs with minimal provocation. I quite disagree. You make parallels to World War II, but you are leaving out many pieces of the puzzle. I share your concern, but I do not agree.
And why not?
Because I believe that such people are capable of reason, that men's ancestors, not too long ago, rose to the challenge of the Renaissance. He can too. And I also believe that to have individuals make their own decisions is far more effective and beneficial than decisions being made by some central authority. You have kept these people, or I should say, helped keep these people, in positions where decisions were either made for them, thrust upon them, or where they were conditioned to make certain choices. How different would the man in the truck be if he had been left to make his own choices in life, rather than being led by the nose through it? You want these people to be carefully managed, and that leaves them no room to grow. Growth requires trial and error, including mistakes and pain. In trying to eliminate pain, you also eliminate the direct confrontation with life that leads to learning.
Donnelly was unhappy with the movement of the conversation and suggested that they move into the front room for after-dinner drinks and cigars. As they went, he nodded to a younger man, perhaps in his 40s, who had earlier been speaking to him quietly.
Drinks were poured all around and cigars distributed to those who wished them. Quite expertly, the younger man drew Philip off to one side for a private conversation. They were seated on two magnificent leather chairs, facing each other at angles, with a low table in between.
"Mr. Donson, my name is Arthur Blackstone, and I'd like to explain this to you a bit differently."
His voice indicated that he was an American, probably from the West Coast. Philip declined the cigar that was offered him, then turned back to Blackstone. "Please, I'm interested."
"You and I have both spent time on American streets, Philip. You do mind if I dispense with the political speech of the older guys?"
Philip smiled. "Not at all."
"Good. Now listen. You certainly have points to make, and we may even adopt some of them.
But you've got to understand, we study these people, and they are not ready for self-rule.
You said you wanted to wake people up, but you're never going to get more than 20% or 30%. That's enough to kill the current governments of the world, but not enough to create a better world system.
If the percentage of people who listen to you ever approached 50%, you'd have a chance.
But they won't wake up, Philip. Your numbers will fall short. You can improve enough people to destroy things, but not enough to build something better."
"And how can you convince me that not enough people would wake up?"
"Because they're suckers for every new manipulation of advertisers and governments. You see it every day, right?"
"Yes, that's mainly true."
"Those people, Philip, the ones who have no critical reasoning skills, you can't reach them. They will not wake up. You could give them the overwhelming evidence, but they're not able to believe you. They're busy with the NBA playoffs, with new TV shows, with life as usual. Hell, how could we really be serfs when primetime comedy and sports keeps rolling along? There's a new hit movie. Have you seen it? Go ahead. Try to fit your message of state servitude into this picture. These people spend all of their conscious lives either at workplaces that we oversee or watching TV shows that our best friends make. I don't care what kind of evidence you say you have. You're an anomaly. And even thinking about you and your evidence bothers these folks. And they don't want to be bothered. Don't you get it? Thinking about your evidence is a pain in the ass. They won't do it. We'll never do it. You're engaged in some sort of moral masturbation, Philip. Joe Average doesn't give a damn whether you're right or not. All the manipulators have to do is to keep their pictures in front of them. Your pictures don't fit in. You are a bother to Joe Average. He wants you to go away. You are trying to interrupt primetime in this week's new mega event. They own these people, Philip. They're addicted. And even if things went very badly, they'd keep coming back. They are conditioned to their Bret and circus culture. To them, those are the good times, and they know no other."
Philip sat back in his chair, thinking about what Blackstone had said. Philip had found long ago that in such situations, it was best to sit back and review the arguments, first to identify the primary factors involved, and then to examine the arguments based upon their fundamentals. Some people seemed to have a gift for coming up with fast answers, but Philip had never been one of them. When he had a fast answer, it was because he had previously thought the matter through at length.
"I'll give you a moment to think about it," said Blackstone. "I should run to the men's room."
It took Blackstone longer than he had expected. Donnelly had spotted him along the way and asked how it went.
"Not bad," said Blackstone, "but he's a careful thinker, and I don't know what he'll come up with next. For now, anyway, he's thinking about what I said."
"Good,"
said Donnelly.
"We've got a place for him if he comes around."
Arthur Blackstone sat down across Philip and remained silent while Philip thought. The other men in the room were giving them space to continue their discussion uninterrupted. Philip took a sip from his glass, then placed it down on the table that sat between the two chairs. He gathered the various thoughts that had crossed his mind in a loose order and began.
"First of all, Arthur, I do not hold one man's need as a legitimate demand upon another. That means that I would not demand that one man to make sacrifices for another. If a man wishes to help someone, I have no problem with it, and may in many cases commend it. But I will not demand it. Because of that alone, I would not attempt to shut down the digital economy. Secondly, I couldn't shut it down if I wanted to."
"The hell you couldn't! It was your theoretical work that put the system into motion, and your essays that brought people in."
Philip laughed.
"And how are you so sure that the essays are mine?"
"Because no one else could have done it. No one else was thinking along those lines. Your earlier publications point directly to the essays, and no one else's do.
Fair enough. As for shutting them down, however, you have made a hugely inaccurate assumption.
And what was that?
That I put the necessary thoughts into those people's heads?
I didn't.
The thoughts were already there. I just gave them some confidence and filled a few blanks. These people already had the basic ideas. They were just afraid to admit it. And as for the essays, those are ideas that I put into cyberspace. They took root on their own and spread because of the individuals who were affected by them. I can't stop that.
Like hell you can't.
And how do you suppose I could stop the essays?
By changing your theories, slowly of course, and bringing them around to the idea that they are better served by not destroying the current system.
Oh, you want me to bullshit them into compliance? Blackstone was about to say,
I wouldn't put it that way.
But he remembered what Philip had said earlier, that making the words sound less ugly does not change the reality.
All right, Philip, you like it blunt, so yes, I do want you to bullshit them, for their own good. If democratic governments fail, there will be anarchy and mass death.
Philip laughed. What is it with you guys? You've all bought the same all-or-nothing lie about governments. What you wrongly call anarchy occurs not when there is no ruler, but when there are competing rulers fighting for sole dominance. When there is no ruler at all, there is usually relative peace. Get your head out of the conditioning factory and look at real history. Next, the governments you love will not just crumble. They will shrink and devolve. There are millions of government employees, and they're not going to all walk away at once. They'll keep their system going as long as possible. They'll adapt and hang on for a long time. So the short answer, Arthur, is that I will not bullshit people for you. If the truth doesn't work, then so be it. I will take my stand on that. And you are deeply mistaken in your view that Donnelly's delivery driver and people like him can't respond to my ideas.
Good luck proving that, Donson. Not only are they absorbed in the entertainment culture, but they get their self-esteem from their politics. They hold to one party or another because it makes them feel like a good person. And you want to take that away from them? They won't give it up. Maybe they'll figure out it's a fraud 1,000 years from now. But for the moment, you can't help them. They're just not up to it. Let them have their farcical homelands, their bullshit political parties, and their groundless mystical beliefs. They're not going to give them up because you tell them the truth. They don't want to know any different. That would require effort, and they want to avoid effort at every possible point. Oh, I know you'll say that living your way would be far easier, but only after they've expended a lot of effort to extract themselves from where they sit now. If you can't give them nearly instant results, they'll turn on you, Donson. Look around and see. If it's not in front of their face, flashing and making noises, they don't care. Period. End of story. Give it up, Philip. You're too smart a guy to waste your time on them. They won't wake up, no matter how loud you yell.
Philip was now getting angry. He thought of Jim's story of the cemetery in Warsaw, and how this man was both criticizing Jim's Shlomos and at the same time trying to prevent them from rising. That's about enough, Blackstone. I'm going to tell you one last thing. Maybe you'll be able to understand it, and maybe not. But when I finish, you'll have heard my final answer. All of your arguments center around the inability of the masses to escape from their mental chains. You are wrong, and I'll tell you why. These Joe averages are not a lesser species than you and I. Their life experiences may differ, and their conditioning certainly differs, but their essence is the same. You see, I used to be an average Joe, Blackstone, and I made it out.
Yes, but you're an extremely unusual case.
And what of my 10 million? Are they all as exceptional as I?
No, they're not. They're just following you.
No, you just can't accept them as equals, can you?
No, I don't. Because as you wrote, reality matters. And the reality is that they do not operate based on reason. They are slaves to emotions that are placed in them by marketers.
No, Blackstone. That's how they act, but it's not essentially what they are. Maybe you're right, and I am as exceptional as you say. But my special talents have not allowed me to do things that the others couldn't do. Only to do certain things faster and better.
I had to build knowledge upon knowledge, just like anyone else. The difference is that I made the mental connections faster, and that I somehow stayed on course. It took me years, decades, to make my way through the forest of obstacles, both ancient and modern, that I found in front of me. Somehow I was able to make it through to the other side while still reasonably young. Then, once I did get through, I began to tell the others how to do it themselves, and where the shortcuts were located. Now they're using my findings to make their own way through it much more easily. How I ended up the one guy who could do this is still a wonder to me. But as long as I am that guy, I will use my abilities to honor and to assist your average Joes. And let me tell you the real crime of your systems. They manage people's minds rather than allowing the power of those minds to be properly used. I can't even imagine how much better life on Earth would be if the great mass of humans actually used their minds appropriately, rather than remaining as partially thinking cogs in your machinery. I will not help you, Blackstone. Philip rose and walked to Donnelly. I am done for the evening, Dr. Donnelly. If you would call a car for me, I'm sure Mr. Blackstone will inform you as to the details of our conversation. Bill and Philip stood silently at the front door, waiting for a car to arrive. As they did, the old man with the English-Australian accent walked up.
I heard your conversation, Mr. Donson.
Philip looked at him as if to say, how could you have? The man smiled.
I sat in the right position and turned my hearing aid all the way up.
Philip laughed. That's beautiful.
In any event, Mr. Donson, I understand your position. Blackstone and Donnelly will oppose your system, but myself and one or two others will undermine them. I'll listen to you carefully, and I think you may be right. At the least, you should be left alone until more results are in.
The man trailed off, seemingly in deep sorrow.
You certainly would know the details, but some of the acts of this organization, mostly before my time, were dead wrong and caused immense suffering.
Yes, sir, I may know some of the actions you're referring to. Even when undertaken benevolently, centralized control is contrary to human nature and yields bitter fruit.
You are a wise man, Dunson.
Then the old man handed him a business card.
I'm not especially good at using the internet, but if you sent me instructions, I'd enjoy corresponding.
Philip, who had always had a special appreciation for old people, smiled and said, Yes, sir, I will certainly send you instructions, and I would be honored to correspond.
Good, I'm pleased. Well, I had best be getting back before they think I've switched sides.
The old man winked smartly and walked away. Philip woke early and went with Bill to meet some of the soldiers who were providing security. The soldiers who understood who Philip was, perhaps a fifth of them, were thrilled. They had Philip autographed t-shirts with the quotations on them and insisted on telling Philip stories. After about half an hour, Bill dragged Philip back inside. Bill went into the meeting, but Philip went back upstairs to nap. At lunch, Bill stopped in their suite to see when Philip was coming back to the meetings. He found Philip asleep in his bed.
Oh, say, Philip, wake up for a minute.
Hi, Bill, what's up?
Philip, it's lunchtime. You've been asleep all morning.
Oh, I got up to read for a while.
Oh, I see. Are you going to skip the whole day?
No, I'll be back down for the last session, and to talk to William again at the bar. By then, I'm sure we'll have another offer for dinner.
Very well. I'll tell that to the people who have been asking for you. Enjoy your rest.
The idea of people asking for him made Philip think. Bill had turned to leave the room.
Bill, wait a minute. Who was asking for me?
Well, William, then one or two people from the last two nights, and a clergyman of some sort. I didn't catch his name.
Why?
You seem to be reading something important into this.
Well, unless I'm mistaken, we're going to have a very interesting meeting with the clergyman and his associates tonight.
And Bill? Philip fumbled for the remote control on the nightstand. Then he turned on the television and spoke very quietly, on the outside chance that there were listening devices in the room.
We should make an unexpected exit this evening after our meeting. If you have anything important that you won't want to carry on your person, overnight it out now.
For our dinner tonight, we'll carry anything we need in our pockets and then just leave.
Yes, yes, I know the drill.
Philip made his way to the hotel lobby mid-afternoon, 10 minutes before the regular DHL pickup. He put some of his papers into a shipping pouch and sent them off to the office of a friend in Spain, something he did fairly regularly. When he was ready, he would ask the friend to ship the papers to him in Greece. Philip then walked over to another cafe area and sipped a cappuccino while watching for the DHL truck. He wanted to be absolutely sure the papers made their way out of the hotel unmolested. As he sat, a young clergyman dressed in a long black robe and priest's collar approached him.
Ah, Mr. Donson.
Yes?
I am Father Ferniox, also attending these meetings. May I join you for a moment?
Philip pulled one of the chairs away from the table and said,
Please do.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome. Just then, the DHL truck pulled out in front of the hotel. Philip watched the driver in his peripheral vision, while trying to pay as much attention as possible to the young priest at the same time. His cup of cappuccino provided a nice diversion while changing his focus from one to the other.
So, Father Ferniox, how are you enjoying the meetings?
Oh, very well. I especially appreciate the quality of the speakers. They understand their subjects thoroughly and also have the necessary skills to explain them in terms that are acceptable to non-specialists.
Yes, that is very nice. But tell me, why were you looking for me?
The young priest smiled slightly.
Some of my superiors would like to have a discussion with you this evening, Mr. Donson. And they asked me to find you and invite you.
I see.
Philip didn't feel like being invited to a meeting with church leaders. Something about it seemed very ominous.
Perhaps it's just hereditary, he thought.
And where would you like to meet? We have a private room reserved at the Heidelberg restaurant in Bonn.
And at what time would you like to meet there?
The reservation is at 8 o'clock.
Very well, then. You may tell your superior that Mr. McCoy and I will attend.
Philip paused for a moment. He wanted to ask what subjects were being discussed, but he knew it would not provide him any further information. This young priest was functioning as an errand boy. Just at that moment, the DHL driver left the front desk for his truck. Philip was able to see his package being loaded in the truck and was relieved. It contained an Argentinian passport in a false name. The priest stood up.
Thank you for agreeing to attend, Mr. Donson. I will see you there.
Yes, I look forward to it,
answered Philip, and returned to sipping his cappuccino and feeling deeply uncomfortable about the evening that lay in front of him.
The last session of the day was on Islam again. This speaker expounded on a plan for a reasonable method to transition from Muslim dictatorships reliant on external hatred for unity to more open societies. Afterward, both Bill and Philip walked out together and over to the bar. It took William longer than usual, but they were in no rush and didn't mind the wait. The young priest had found Bill and invited him to the dinner as well.
So, Philip, are you expecting some fireworks at the meeting tonight?
I'm not really sure, Bill. With the other meetings, I knew what to expect. With this one, I don't know. I think it all depends on their estimation of me. I think they see me as having some weight philosophically, but I'm not sure if it goes any further than that. They may think I'm a wild eccentric, or they may see me as a very serious threat. I'm just not sure.
So you want to play it for the worst-case scenario?
Absolutely.
The bartender asked them for their orders. Today, they both had fruit juice. The two of them sat, each silently thinking about the evening's event and all the likely possibilities. For a long time, they were content just to sit together and to say nothing.
Philip, I have an idea.
Go ahead.
We should walk to the restaurant. I checked, and it's only a couple of kilometers.
We'll just say we haven't had much exercise and that we decided to walk.
Then, on the way out, we hang out with the soldiers again and make plans for them to pick us up at the restaurant, perhaps at 10 o'clock, to go out drinking together. That way, we end up walking out to the restaurant with a military escort, and we'll have our blokes following as well.
That's brilliant, Bill. That's our plan.
Again, they sat in near silence. After several more minutes, William walked over.
Ah, the boys who are making so many people worried.
Philip smiled, but with a bit of pain in his face. So is that the word on the street?
Yes, Philip, I'm afraid so. They say that you're so buried in your philosophy that you wouldn't listen to Jesus Christ himself.
Are they at least relieved that I'm retiring? William smiled sadly.
I'm sorry, Philip. I'm afraid they don't believe you on that score.
So they think I'm addicted to power?
No, worse. They think you're some unusual sort of political-religious zealot, except they can't quite figure out what your hidden beliefs are.
They all laughed in pained tones. So do they think they're sending me to Jesus' representatives tonight? William looked concerned for the first time. He looked around and spoke very quietly.
Philip, there may be things about the church that you don't know.
Philip understood his concern and matched his secretive tone of voice. You can relax, William. I know. William looked concerned, as if to say,
or maybe you just think you know.
So Philip continued to keep his voice very low and went on. I know how deeply they are involved in world affairs, and that they wield more global influence than anyone would ever admit publicly. That they have amazing resources, and that while religion is their public business, their private business is to direct the rulers of the earth, by 100 techniques, into the paths they wish for them. Now William looked just as scared as before, but with some additional confusion mixed in. He spoke in the same hushed tones.
How did you learn this?
Philip tilted his head and spread his hands in a deprecating gesture.
I did a lot of studying and put two and two together.
Then, luckily, I was able to confirm it with some intelligence agents. William looked directly into Philip's eyes for just a moment, trying to convince himself that Philip was telling him the truth, that he had figured this out by himself. He paused just a moment, dropping his head halfway. Then he raised his eyes back to Philip and said,
In that case, sir, you are a genius.
Thank you.
Yes, you are welcome. But listen to me, Philip. I have to leave in just a moment. Before I do, I have one more thing I need to say. Be very careful what you talk about tonight. A complete record will be made of the evening's events, and they will assign 4 or 5 men to analyze everything you say. And this team of analysts will be very, very good. If they haven't done it already, they will find some young priests and order them to infiltrate your system. They'll spend years, if necessary, doing absolutely nothing but infiltrating your system. Remember, their people have no wives and children, none of the usual obligations, and they are very well educated indeed.
William paused, searching his brain for any last thing he should tell Philip before he left.
Remember, they always have contingency plans, and they have unlimited resources, including hundreds of millions of deeply faithful followers.
All right, I must go now, Philip.
You will be careful.
Yes, William, I promise.
Good. Do let me know how it turns out, will you?
Yes, I will. William walked back toward the meeting rooms, and Philip and Bill both turned around on their bar stools, facing the front of the Maritime, with their backs resting against the bar. They spoke to each other in half monotones, while looking straight ahead, rather than at each other.
You thought it better not to tell him that we're leaving tonight?
Yes. Better for him that he should be surprised along with everyone else.
Yes, good call.
As the man sat at the bar, silently, a man who appeared to be a very serious clergyman approached.
Mr. Donson and Mr. McCoy, I am Monsignor Albino.
They shook hands.
I'm pleased to meet you.
Philip and Bill returned the pleasantries.
They told me that you will join us for dinner this evening.
Yes, said Philip. But I'm quite lost as to what you would like to talk about. Would you care to give me some idea on the subject matter?
May I join you? Asked the clergyman.
Of course, said McCoy, as he motioned them all to a group of chairs a few meters away. They sat.
Mr. Donson, we wish to talk about your ideas.
Philip didn't respond, leaving a slightly uncomfortable pause and inducing the clergyman to continue.
You have turned morality upside down in your teachings, Mr. Donson.
You are opposed to selflessness. You disdain unity. You are quite at war with altruism. Those are quite opposite to what almost the whole world believes, and such ideas concern us.
Yes, I'm sure they do, but your statement is not precisely correct.
And how is it not?
I have read your work. I'm not seeking to defeat altruism and the others, only to tell the truth that they are misstatements and are fraudulent as they are commonly used. That is, that they do not match reality and are therefore false. These truths having been told, my work is done.
Very well, I understand.
Philip continued. You also said that my writings are opposed to what almost all the world believes. That is only true in a certain sense. People do service altruism, selflessness, and unity with their lips, but their inner natures are quite different. They pretend to believe in those things, thinking that they are supposed to, but although they may learn to pretend quite well, their true natures do not agree. And this is not a minor issue, since the anti-self ideals act as substitutes and tend to displace authentic virtues such as self-acknowledgement, integrity, understanding, and the desire to bless. The Monsignor was silent for quite a while, then finally spoke.
I can see why so many people are concerned about you, Mr. Dunson. Your ideas have a certain uniqueness and simplicity to them. I think we will enjoy our discussion this evening. But until then, I must undertake other activities. Good afternoon.
The clergyman stood and walked away. Again, Philip and Bill sat silently. And again, Philip began thinking about how many men with new ideas had been called before the council of concerned church leaders. Galileo, Wycliffe, John Huss, and countless others. Now he was preparing to walk into their council, willingly. Well, my reason for going... He stopped. His reason for going was inertia. He had gone to the other meetings, so he had simply continued the pattern. Not good enough. He said to him sternly, "Why should I go?" he asked himself. "They know everything they're going to know about me, and I already know far more about them than they'd ever admit." "Bill?" "Uh-huh. Aside from simple inertia, why are we going tonight?"
"I'm not sure, Philip. It's rather been your game here."
"Yes, I know. Can you think of a good reason?"
No, I can't."
Now Philip laughed. He was thinking of Farber and his unassailable locker room logic. "Nothing to gain," he would say. "Ditch him." Philip stood up. "Come on, Bill. We've got 2.5 hours before they're going to start looking for us. Let's get the hell out of here." McCoy looked at him quizzically, not understanding what he meant.
"Screw him. We're cutting class. Let's go catch a train."
They picked up the best cigars available at the hotel store and lit them in celebration as they walked out the door. They exchanged greetings with a few soldiers and walked down the street. A few blocks later, they caught a passing taxi and went to the Cologne train station. They caught the first train out, headed to Milan. As usual, they purchased their tickets with cash, leaving no trace. McCoy called his 3 men from the train station and told them to conduct surveillance at the Heidelberg restaurant, to email a report to him, and to cancel the operation. Surveillance, Heidelberg Restaurant, Bonn, Germany, August 23rd. 10 clergymen gathered in a private room at the restaurant, which is an old 2-story brick building, very secure structure. The facility was closed to all other patrons from 1900 to closing. We were able to place 1 wireless listening device at the entrance of the dining room prior to all patrons being removed. Transmission quality was not good, but we were able to understand some of the conversation. More later. The private party, all clergy, arrived in 3 limousines at 1945. They entered the private room, and 1 man said something about a conversation with Mr. Dunson. Details unclear. At about 2010, they became concerned that you and Mr. Dunson had not arrived. They phoned the hotel and could not find you. There was further conversation about your whereabouts, but we could not understand it. At 10:30, they ordered their food and ate. At 21:03, they said that you and Mr. Dunson would not show up, and they began to discuss how to undermine Mr. Dunson's ideas. As mentioned earlier, details were difficult to perceive, but main points were as follows. First, that they should identify every exception and any inconsistency in the philosophy.
then to expose such a flaw as if they were the only thing that mattered. Second, to fill any gaps in the philosophy with simple, instinctive ideas that supported traditional beliefs. Third, to develop a network of friends in Gamma circles, to turn these people into leading voices, that these people should inject the ideas that support church and state interests. Fourth, to bring Gamma people back, step by step, into traditional thinking. They suggested that this may take several decades, but that in time they would succeed. Fifth, to make the philosophy seem very complicated and difficult to understand, thus repelling uninfected people from it. To do this by arguing publicly and continuously over the most arcane and difficult portions of the philosophy, to artificially complicate them as required. Sixth, to assign their best people to this work. Numbers were mentioned, 50, 100, 200, but we could not ascertain which they agreed upon. Also, that these people would have complete cooperation at every level. At 22:44, the group left the restaurant and returned to Hotel Maritime, arriving at 22:57. End of report. Prague Spring had energized the Gamma communities. The vast majority of them had not attended, but the very concept of such events, of such a style of living, was contagious. People now looked for opportunities to gather. None of this was lost on the skunk teams. Some of them had attended, and a number of them now committed themselves to riding shotgun for the festivals. One group provided aerosol tranquilizers, so that if one person was accosted by police, a dozen others, called on their cell phone, would swarm around and use their sprays to drop the policeman. So far, there was no need for this, but it would be foolish to be unprepared. They had other means of self-protection as well. The hunters were infiltrating every border control computer they could. Rather than shutting them down altogether, they randomly flooded the system with so much useless data that the systems did not operate. This could be done for days on end if a number of Gamma people needed to get in or out of some place undetected. It also made border crossing surveillance too expensive to maintain. Francis and James kept the house in Lycée, but rented it out for a year and went from Prague to an Italian town on the Mediterranean called Marina di Massa. It was close enough to several larger towns to provide all the services they needed and surrounded by other small resort towns to spread their visibility. James and Francis had found this town a few years earlier and talked about going there to a number of people in Prague. They weren't sure about how many people would show up, but it was quite possible that there would be hundreds. They arrived in Marina di Massa in mid-September. Francis had refused to show up until tourist season was over. "I don't want their pre-packaged fun," she said. "I want to create my own."
"Julia, when are you going to come see us? It's been something like 2 years.
Francis missed Julia, and she was also concerned about her. She tried not to call Julia too often. Something gave her the impression that it would be better that way. But now she had a bit of time on her hands, and she wanted to understand what was going on inside of Julia. It might be more difficult later, if a lot of people showed up here in Italy like they had in Prague. Finishing her medical degree and residency had been important to Julia for reasons that eluded her. She understood that Julia had always wanted to be a doctor, but she was so focused on it these past years that she had done almost nothing else. She and James had tried repeatedly to get her to visit, to no avail. She didn't even write very often.
"Well, Francis, I think I can come soon."
"So you're done with everything you need to?"
"For now, though I still have a few loose ends to clean up."
Francis was relieved. For a moment, she wanted to convince Julia to move to Europe and join them. But that seemed too much too fast. Julia was traveling her own path. But what path? Francis wondered. There was an element to Julia's medical career that she didn't understand.
"Oh, I'm very pleased, Julia. We're going to be here on the Italian coast all winter, and I really want you to see my kids."
"Oh, I promise, Francis. I'll be there by the first of the year." Just then Jessica cried.
"Oh, I should take care of the baby, Julia. Can I call you back later?"
"Sure," she said. "I should be here all day today."
"Great, I'll see you then."
She hung up the phone, picked up Jessica, and took her to the changing table. It was only a dirty diaper. She kept thinking about Julia. Julia and Philip. In many ways, they really belonged together. And in others, they constantly irritated each other. She wondered whether this could be any resolution to the situation, or whether it was simply a lost cause. Certainly it wasn't her problem to fix.
but she did care about both of these people.
Jim, she hollered across the hall, would you please take over for me here?
It took him a couple of seconds.
Yeah, I suppose so. Something important? Yeah, I need to talk to Anna. Do you have their phone number?
Well, I'm not sure, but I just saw her online 2 minutes ago. Frances almost jumped away from the changing table, but kept one hand on the baby. Jim took over for her.
Have you still got the programs up?
He laughed.
Go, I'm sure she's still there.
Frances ran.
Anna, you still here? Hey, Frances, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Well, tell me about where you are now.
Anna, you should come if you can. The place is deserted now, and we have the beaches all to ourselves. There are grand adventures to be had for the kids, and endless expeditions to be taken. We pull a couple of American-style grills out to the beach most nights, and we've invented all sorts of meals. Great wine is cheap here. The stars are vivid. There are Etruscan sites nearby, not to mention Roman ruins everywhere. And the most interesting people are starting to come through now.
Well, I'll talk to Larry and see what we can do. He's received offers from 2 virtual universities recently, one of them a very respectable name. He took one of those offers, but don't get your hopes up too high. We'll see.
Cool. Let me know as soon as you decide.
Absolutely.
Listen, Anna, I have some questions for you.
Okay, what subject?
Your parents.
Lol, okay, go ahead.
Well, it seems to me that in some ways they really belong together. But when they are together, they seem to grate on each other. Am I wrong?
No, you're correct. It was always that way.
Okay. Well, Jim is always adamant that I shouldn't meddle in such things, and I agree, mostly. But I really do want to understand this.
What are the core issues?
All right, let me try to help you with this. My mom and dad get along wonderfully when they have a single focus. If you needed 2 people to save you in an emergency, they would be an excellent choice. But when the situations are more mundane, dad always pushes mom too far.
Explain that last part, please.
Sure. You know how dad is always coming up with new ideas and is overwhelmingly passionate about them.
Yeah, right.
Well, this is too much for mom. Let's see how I can put this in terms that will resonate with you, okay? Imagine yourself being married to a genius economist who is also the best writer, you know. And he has this overflowing passion. He comes up with every new idea before you can get close to it. Now couple that with some childhood difficulties that left you with an inferiority wound. How would you feel?
Yeah, pretty bad.
Right? That's the picture. That can be pretty difficult to live with. His passions overwhelm and displace the more mundane things of life. Things that most people, including mom, find comfort in. Is this making sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Rachel and I once decided that dad really should have been born in the future. He wouldn't be the oddball there. And mom shouldn't have gotten together with dad until she was older and independently accomplished.
Smart kids.
Huh, I think we were 12 and 13 at that time.
Okay, let me give you an example of this.
Please.
You know that dad can be something of an ascetic.
Huh?
Well, not in the usual sense, but you should see him when he's working on new ideas. He eats and sleeps, of course, but only because he needs to.
I remember my mom making nice meals, and him either missing them altogether.
You guys go ahead and start, I'll be there soon.
Or sitting, eating, saying thank you, and going directly back to work.
Anyway, there's nothing really wrong about that. But mom comes from a more traditional background, where the husband's duty is to sit, eat, and really appreciate the meal. Dad just isn't wired that way. He appreciates the meal, but ordering out would do just as well. This kind of thing happened a lot. It left mom feeling grossly underappreciated.
I see. And your dad's perspective on this?
Mostly that mom was being unreasonable. He quite understood her concerns and tried to accommodate them, but his basic nature is so different.
How different?
When he tries to care about man-made obligations, holidays for example, he just can't do it. To him, it's as if he'd been selling out to tradition and obligations that should have died out centuries ago.
Why should your happiness be destroyed by something like that? I remember him saying.
He obviously loved Mom, but he felt it was fraud to prove his love by giving her gifts. If he had to prove it with things, well, in his mind, that was insulting to both of them. I'm beginning to see what you mean. Have they seen each other recently? No, not really. Not in a while. I think they've only seen each other in a couple of times since your wedding. I think Mom needs her space. Kind of regrouping after the 25 years dad storm. Huh. Speaking of, where is your dad now? He seems to have retired as promised. Yeah, I got an email from him yesterday. Get this. He's doing a slow motion tour of health spas in Eastern Europe. He was in Bulgaria. Now I'm laughing. How does he sound? As always, but a bit less animated. As if his attention has turned inward, or something like that. But mainly the same. Okay, I should get back to the kids now. Thanks, Anna, you helped a lot. My pleasure. Are you planning anything for my folks?
Starting to, for your mom.
Good, let me know what you come up with.
Absolutely. Later.
Jim, I'm taking on a project.
You mean beside the 18 hours a day you spend on the kids? He smiled, and she smiled back.
You know what I mean, smart guy.
He laughed.
Yes, of course I do. And what sort of project might this one be? I think I'm going to make Julia rich and famous.
He looked at her in wonder. What?
You heard me. I want to see Julia getting huge accolades and money.
Okay, you want to tell me why?
Yes, so she can stand next to Philip on even ground.
Jim looked very doubtful.
Francis, I don't want to meddle in their relationship. That's their set of problems to work out, and a very complicated set of problems, I might add. Listen, Jim, I don't know if they'll ever want to get back together again, but I do want to make it possible. And until Julia feels like she can stand on the same level as Philip, that can't happen.
Okay, I see your point. But it will never be external things that can make Julia feel that way. It has to be within her. If you just provide things to her, she'll never get the inner strength you're talking about.
Frances stopped, then laughed at herself. Oh, I'm sorry, Jim. I was being a bit dramatic and wasn't terribly clear. Of course you're correct. What I should have said, that I was going to make myself available to Julia. If she wants to do important and noteworthy things, which I think she does, I'll be there to encourage her and to help.
But only if she asks, Francis. Otherwise, you can ruin the whole thing.
All right, only if she asks. But I am going to be available. Agreed?
Agreed.
Good. Oh, and one more thing, James. I'm not going to be afraid of Julia getting public attention. There is a certain amount of self-esteem that people really do get from other people's approval. Perhaps that's not ideal, but it is the way most of us are.
She paused.
Although I wouldn't want to see Julia rely on that.
James watched silently as her mind took a step forward.
Perhaps that's the problem with it, Jim. Maybe enjoying acclaim is fine, but needing it is not. That would make sense.
James smiled.
That's a good point, Francis. Well done. Thank you, she said.
And she hugged him, laid the baby down, and went to her computer to make some notes. 2 hours later, she called Julia and talked for a long time. On October 5th, the Free Soul webpage posted a headline stating that Prester John had retired. Within 2 hours, the note was on 4 other websites. Aside from the news of the retirement, which was a surprise to most who read it, the text went on to say that PJ was writing a public explanation of the reasons for his retirement, and that all was well with him. On October 6th, several dozen widely scattered people became intellectuals. Most of them didn't think of it that way, but somewhere in their psyche, they committed themselves to the future of humanity. They decided that they would study, analyze, and help to create a better world for themselves and for their descendants. It would be months before most of them would begin to put new ideas together, and longer before many of those ideas matured. But their paths were set. It is said that nature abhors a vacuum. And so it seemed that Philip's act of leaving pulled these people in, by some unseen mechanism drawing them from their previous lives into something grander. James Farber sat on the deserted beach at Marina di Massa almost every morning, alternately playing with the children and working on his new essay.
In most ways, he and Francis were separating themselves from daily contact with world affairs. He had moved all of his asset into safe, long-term investments and had four money managers competing with each other for a larger share of his portfolio. This required attention only once per month when his statements came in. He didn't even check the news much anymore. He felt strangely about this. So different was it from his habit of the past 30-some years. But he also felt liberated by it, as if he had stepped away from a wearing struggle. His only interest in world affairs now was keeping track of wars and oppression. So long as he could avoid those, little else interested him. On November 2nd, his original essay was rerun in the Wall Street Journal, 1 month later than the 2-year anniversary date he had planned. Again, it was a full page, paid for from one of the few remaining bank accounts in his real name. At the bottom of the page, a note indicated that there would be a new essay the next day. On November 3rd, the new essay ran in the journal, in the Financial Times and in the Times of London. This one would also have an effect, but predominantly on the more enterprising type of young people, which was not what he had expected. He wondered where this would lead, but also had a strange sort of resignation about it. He had done his part, and whatever came of it was fine. Perhaps he would do more in the future, but he felt no compulsion. His life was his own now, to be enjoyed with family, friends, and with ideas that he cared about. Frances spent her time taking care of the children, doing a little bit of writing and playing hostess to the stream of interesting people that were coming to Marina di Massa. On many days, she and the children made projects of gathering pieces of driftwood on the beach and fashioning them into wonderful tables, benches, ornaments, and wine racks, making their beach beautiful. All that was required was some glue, a few nails or screws, and some imagination. Other times, she sat on the beach with children, both her own and others, and taught them their school lessons. And almost always, people passing by would offer to help. As a result, these children, and there were many families with children here, were taught arithmetic, algebra, and geometry by noted mathematicians, economics by university professors, science by top physicists, and writing by professional authors. No better education at any price could have been found. What made it truly spectacular was that these teachers were doing this for the love of learning, for their love of improving children. More than once, a Nobel laureate sat in the sand, surrounded by a dozen children, illustrating concepts with pebbles. Seeds were planted in these children that would later mature wonderfully. The children formed movable, changing packs. On one day, there would be a trip to nearby ruins. One group of children might go there, while another group would stay on the beaches, learning either from each other, from a parent, or from capable teachers who passed by. There may also be astronomy lessons at night, sailing lessons, and music lessons all the same day. None of this was organized. The people who taught did so because they got enjoyment from it. The children cooked, cleaned, and mixed seamlessly with the adults whenever they wished to. And when they wanted to play with the other children, there were almost always responsible adults watching at a distance. Frequently, a group of adults would take trips to Roma or Firenze for a few nights. Those with children would leave them with friends and would generally return the favor later. The natives of Marina di Massa were shocked that the beaches were active. This had never happened in living memory. There didn't seem to be any pattern to the activity, just people walking or driving from beach to beach, where people wearing warm clothing were coming and going, cooking, playing, and talking. While the weather wasn't very cold by North American standards, the locals thought these people must be quite mad, sitting on the beach during winter. On the other hand, a great number of Gamma people took short-term leases on the stores that were closed for the winter. They used these for offices and meeting rooms. This, of course, pleased the locals immensely. By the time spring approached, landlords were competing for the next year's off-season leases and trying to make sure that these people, whoever they were, would come back. The phone line from rural Greece to rural Canada was surprisingly good. Michael had obtained the phone number of the little inn from McCoy and called to check in on Philip. It was winter now. Philip had finished his spa tour and settled into a small Greek resort town. So, Philip, tell me, are you enjoying retirement?
Yeah, Mike, I am doing nothing and loving it.
So it's been quiet?
Mm-hmm.
McCoy was here a few days ago, but aside from that,
nice and quiet.
But I do have a few things on my calendar.
Such as?
Oh, a couple of my grandkids are going to visit soon. I'm going to visit Jim and Francis before too long.
Good, that sounds perfect. Hear anything from Julia?
Yeah, she called the other day. I think she's going to get out of the US finally.
Good. Do you think you guys will start spending more time together now?
You know, Mike, I just can't tell. We'll see.
And how are you feeling?
He laughed. Well, it's strange. I've been sleeping like a teenager, sometimes 12 hours a day. I think I'm just unwinding. I am enjoying the rest, but I think it will be a while before I unwind enough to locate myself. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. And it means that you pushed yourself way, way too far.
Over the past 2 years, Philip had become, for the first time in his life, concerned for his health. He knew that his perpetual overextension had put him at risk. Although he was not sick, he felt that all his reserves had been depleted.
What would you recommend I do, Michael?
Well, just what you're doing. Eat well, keep sleeping, and be sure to get enough sex. Most people mentioning sex would joke about it. Michael was completely serious.
All right, I will do that. Anything else?
No, except that eating well should include vitamins, minerals, sufficient protein, and so on. Would you like me to send you a list of specifics?
Yes, please. I'll get it to you right away.
Thanks. Philip trusted Michael's opinion implicitly. He knew that his information was the best available, and that unless he had strong reason to do otherwise, he would follow it precisely.
So come on, Michael. What have you been working on? I want to know.
Oh gosh, Philip, lots of things. You know we sold off the Breakers company.
Right, and George is doing some part-time supervision.
And I've got a free lifetime pass to all their research projects.
Philip laughed hard. Good negotiation, Michael. I'm impressed.
Yeah, and now that my new book is in print, I've been getting very eclectic. Although I've been drawn more and more to Moreno's old work in psychodrama.
Really? I remember one Moreno guest lecture at UC. He really impressed me.
Yeah, me too. And his work is really very interesting. Not to mention shockingly effective at times.
Philip noticed himself getting excited about Michael's work, feeling a big idea coming on, but then he abruptly stopped.
I am retired now, he said to himself. I can't go down that road.
His mind paused as he felt something else bubbling up in it.
No, I can take that road. Short trips down that road. Day hikes only. I just can't take on any new projects.
So what are the interesting things you've been looking into?
Well, I've been thinking about why the physical actions of the psychodrama technique were more effective than the talking cure. And it seems as though the brain deals with abstract inputs, such as ideas denominated in words, differently than it does physical inputs, such as moving and speaking.
Michael paused for a moment to let Philip absorb the idea, and then to respond. But Philip didn't respond. There was silence on the other end of the phone line.
Philip, are you there?
Michael heard commotion in the background.
Philip?
He heard a voice that must have been several feet away from the telephone handset.
Yeah, Michael, I'm here. Hold on a minute.
Philip sounded desperately busy doing something. Michael began to worry that something was terribly wrong on Philip's end, but then he remembered. Philip was coming up with a new idea.
I need to get this on paper. I can't forget this one.
Philip was desperately serious.
All right, Michael, say that again, the last part about inputs.
Okay, the brain handles physical inputs differently than it does abstract inputs. Physical inputs are generally taken with more gravity.
Yes, that's it. Hang on while I write this down.
Michael waited for about half a minute, listening to Philip mutter to himself. Finally, Philip picked the phone back up.
Okay, Michael, listen to this. Do you remember Mark Twain's definition of faith?
Philip's pause was not nearly long enough for Michael to say,
No, I don't.
Twain joked that faith was believing in something you know isn't so. And for most people, that's true. But there's another kind of faith. I've experienced it several times. It feels like a heightened state of consciousness, like a creative force. It feels like it's your proper place to make demands upon the universe.
In any event, you've just given me the key. The brain handles physical inputs differently than it does abstract inputs.
almost as if the two used different circuitry.
Philip was obviously clear in his own mind about this, but Michael was not.
So?
Philip's voice dropped in pitch.
So, what if faith, and the Greek term is persuasion, what if the real faith is when the brain is persuaded to treat abstract inputs in the same way as it treats physical inputs? To run abstract impulses through the physical circuitry?
I'm not exactly sure what the results would be, but it would certainly be an altered sort of consciousness. And perhaps it would open up new channels of the intellect. Oh, Michael, this could be rich. Maybe it's only an explanation of how superstition works, which would be important by itself. But what if there is a way to open new or forgotten mental abilities? I don't know, P, but it could be important.
Oh, hell yeah, it could be important.
All right, I'm going to write this up a little bit better. And maybe follow the reasoning a bit.
Philip stopped again.
What is it, Philip?
Music. This could explain music's powerful impact on people. The mixing of auditory input, a physical stimulus, with the abstract inputs of sound movements and lyrics.
Okay, I'm sorry, Michael. I'm getting ahead of myself here.
Philip paused, remembering why he was retired and why it was the right thing to do.
All right, Michael, I'm going to spend a few minutes on this and send you my notes. But after that, it's up to you to post them on the internet or to follow up yourself or something, okay? I'm retired.
No problem, P. I'll make sure they are distributed one way or another.
Thank you, Michael, my friend. You are a genius. Ciao.
Okay, Philip, see ya soon.
It was frequently that way with Philip. He latched onto a new idea with seemingly primal force, so much that it was hard to tell whether he was an ecstatic genius or simply a madman. You were generally left with the thought, well, time will tell.
And usually, time told that Philip was onto something. Philip wrote his notes and emailed them to Michael within the hour. Then he purposely cleared the subject from his thoughts.
Retiring it was the image that passed through his mind, and took a nap.
He woke later that day and printed out Michael's nutritional instructions which had just arrived. Then he showered, dressed, and went to town to buy ingredients. Also to look for a Spanish woman he had met a few days earlier.
To all my friends, I suppose that most of you already know that I have retired. It has been a couple of months now, and I am very happy with my decision. Not only did I need to retire, but you needed me to retire as well. Let me explain. I have spent nearly my whole life working very hard, striving against huge obstacles, and taking on the most difficult projects. For whatever reason, I was compelled to do these things, and truthfully, I am glad that I did most of them. But I also worked myself far too hard. I have studied other men who have been similarly motivated, and they all paid a severe price in physical health, and sometimes in mental health. I am not willing to continue down that road. Although my health has remained, I can tell that I have damaged myself. I think that I stopped before I did permanent damage, that I will recover. I certainly hope so. But in either case, I am taking a long time off, at least 10 years, and perhaps the rest of my life. In addition to this, the digital economy needs me to retire. As you know, I have played a rather central role in the development of the gamma markets, the early tango market, and in forming the philosophy behind these ventures. My essays have been widely distributed and quoted. All that is fine, and I do enjoy appreciation. But if I hang around, people will begin to rely upon me, rather than rising to challenges on their own. My real job was to put important ideas in front of you, and hopefully to make them easily understood. It has never been my place to lead you and guide you. That is your own job and no one else's. So if I'm considered a leader, it is my duty to remove myself. You have to live on your own. Leaders, especially charismatic leaders, provide a way for people to avoid living themselves and to live vicariously through the leader. I do not want to come anywhere close to that. You don't need me anymore, if in fact you ever really did. Other people will step up and do my work, just as I stepped up to follow those who preceded me. And, with me out of the way, those people will be forced to come up with their own new ideas, to think on their own, to expand their consciousness, to open new territory. You truly are better without me. I do not want to leave the impression that I will never be heard of again. I have plenty of friends that I keep in touch with, and I will certainly be buying and selling in Gamma. But my days as a serious player are over. All of this being said, there are a few ideas I want to leave you with. These are mostly scattered pieces from my notes that never got published and that seemed worthy. Make of them what you will. Your life is far too important not to be lived. Accept no substitutes and be leery of delays. Keep thinking, keep improving, keep creating. Remember that once people leave their pursuit of the high and great, they are left to define their happiness by comparison with their neighbors. That gets ugly in a hurry. Stay with your principles. Once you deviate from them, you give the law of unintended consequences room to operate. Choose to experience your life unrestrainedly. To vigorously use all of your talents, abilities, passions, and strengths. To move forward without guilt or shame. To revel in what you do and can do. To do it forcefully. To be without apology. Learn to think about primary factors and to avoid categorization. For example, don't just apply the words good or bad to something. Go deeper and consider the benefits and harms caused by the thing in question. Know things for what they truly are, not as objects that fit in certain categories. There is no purpose of life, as most people seek. The only meaning to your life is the meaning you give it. That scares many people, but it also means that you get full credit for every good thing you do. Be valiant for the truth. Remember that we have all been negatively affected by life on Earth. We have all been damaged to one extent or another. Remember also that some of this was purely chance. Most of us in the digital economy have been less damaged than average. People born into worse situations, to illiterate families, to violent families, to drug-addicted families, may not escape their damage as quickly as we have. Don't demean them. Remember that the dominant culture of the 20th century featured a continual effort to locate, glorify, and manipulate the basest aspects of human nature. Good was frequently dismissed simply because it was good. It will take time for people to get over this. You have many powerful enemies. The freer you get, the more clearly you will see and understand life. And seeing more clearly means that you will perceive not only wonderful new things that you can do, you will also recognize for the first time some very unpleasant things that are difficult to bear. Remember that the errors of logic and psychology you rightly oppose are necessary for some people. They are the cloak that protects them from things too painful to face. Do not simply take away their cloak. If you cannot replace the cloak with something better, leave them alone until you can. Do not break the damaged person. Heal them. When we become truly healthy, there will be no need for embarrassment, no need for shame. We will be happy about ourselves and what we do. This will occur incrementally, as we revalue and improve ourselves, and as we eliminate mystical and false standards of morality. This will not happen instantly or without some pain. Like the bound feet of ancient Chinese women, our souls have been bound by backwards morality. Do not think that simply removing the bindings will be enough. There will be significant adjustment involved. But a warping of the soul is not as permanent as the warping of bones. We may always remake ourselves, though the process may require significant effort. If you have been deeply damaged and fear that you will never be able to reach greatness, know that you may always do things to make greatness possible for others. and know that this too is a form of greatness, and not a minor one. Remember that I have loved you. P.J.